On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian Chee here. And have you thought about just how effective your firewall is? Well, a new survey uncovers that organizations have severe reservations of just how effective they are. We'll talk about it. Plus, a lot of you have a ton of IoT devices on your network. Have you thought about how you can detect some of the rogue ones out there? Well, we'll talk about that. Plus, we have a great guest, Mr. Mike Paler. He's the Vice President of Product Engineering of Upwork. And he's here to talk about how the industry has changed this past year and just where organizations are focusing their talent searches. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to making securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 417, recorded October 30th, 2020. Building a remote engineering team. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Barracuda. One of Barracuda's premier customers is PetSmart, which used Barracuda and Microsoft's help to quickly secure the remote business during the pandemic. Check out Barracuda's latest recorded webinar to learn how at barracuda.com/PetSmart. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, especially with everything else you have to consider today. But there's one place where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. That place ZipRecruiter. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twit. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big giant world, the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the experts, especially Mr. Curtis Franke, because he's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. And Curtis, how are you, my friend? Are you keeping busy down there in the state of Florida?
Always staying busy. We're sitting here enjoying the first brief hint of some fall-like weather. Only went up into the 70s today. So it's lovely and great weather for sitting here thinking about security and meeting everyone on Twit.
I wish we could say the same about the Pacific Northwest. But speaking of good weather, I'm going to guess that our very own geek in paradise has been pretty good weather down there. He's also the net architect at Sky Fiber, Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, how are you doing, my friend? And how is the great state of Hawaii doing down there?
Oh, we're taking some bad press about people not having the right COVID tests when they arrive and one couple turned back. It's not a good thing. So in the meantime, Sky Fiber is actually working on providing internet services to a large park so that we can set up instant COVID testing for a large population in the Waikiki area, and it's being driven by the folks in the tourism world. But in the meantime, I am getting really close to being able to pull the trigger on getting the moving company scheduled. So the move from Honolulu to the great state of Florida, the clock is going to start ticking very soon.
Very nice. Very nice. Exciting. Exciting. Well, speaking of exciting, it's been a pretty exciting week in the enterprise. Now, let me ask you a question. How effective is your firewall? Well, a new survey actually uncovers that organizations have some pretty severe reservations about the effectiveness of their firewall. We'll definitely talk about that. Plus, you probably have a lot of IoT devices on your network. Well, we're going to discuss just how you might pinpoint some of the rogue ones out there. Plus, we have a great guest today. He's Mike Paler. He's the Vice President of Product and Engineering at Upwork. We're talking about how the industry is changing and just what sectors of the market your organization might want to focus their talent on. But before we get to all that, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, it wouldn't be an enterprise week without a leak. Now, this season, retailers are actually pushing hard for online orders. Some home improvement retailers have done well during the entirety of the pandemic. However, during the holidays, they were hoping for another boost until the hackers decided to target them, that is. Home Depot Canada has confirmed a data breach that has exposed hundreds of customer orders. Not thousands, but hundreds for now. The data contains names, physical addresses, email addresses, order details, and partial credit card information. Now, Home Depot actually has responded here about the breach. And they said, quote, Tuesday evening, we discovered a systems error on our select HomeDepot.ca orders impacting a small number of Canadian customers. Some customers may have received multiple emails for orders they did not place. This issue has been fixed. None of the emails contain passwords or unhashed payment card information. Now, it seems to me that they are just attempting to diminish the blowback here, because if you remember, Home Depot was the subject to the most highly profiled data breaches ever to come back into light into 2014. 50 million credit card numbers were stolen and 53 million email addresses were stolen by unknown attackers. Now, Home Depot agreed in 2018 to pay $19.5 million to compensate the victims of the incident. Now, the breach here is actually rooted from attackers using compromised vendor credentials to gain access to network and the company's point of sale system. Now, this is definitely bigger than what Home Depot is alluding to here. Now, some users are actually reporting they got over 660 emails of different people's orders. There's actually an image there in the article. It's pretty interesting to see that the inbox actually has 660 emails from Home Depot, and all of them are different orders. Now, one hopes that Matt Carey, the CTO of Home Depot, has a plan here, hopefully to get beyond supply chain technology and maybe have a better security model.
Well, a new wave of ransomware is targeting U.S. hospitals and healthcare organizations. Let's talk about what we know so far. U.S. government agencies have issued a joint security advisory following a series of ransomware attacks against hospitals across the country. The activity follows an increase in ransomware attacks throughout this year, as well as recent surges of coronavirus in the U.S. The FBI, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, and the Department of Health and Human Services claim to have, quote, credible information of an increased and imminent cybercrime threat to U.S. hospitals and healthcare providers, end quote. As of this time, Wyckoff Heights Medical Center in Brooklyn and the University of Vermont Health Network are the latest victims of the Ryuk ransomware attack spree, which is covering the healthcare industry. Three other hospital chains have recently confirmed cyber attacks believed to be ransomware by the same gang. Those three are the Sky Lakes Medical Center with 21 locations in Oregon, Dickinson County Healthcare Systems in Michigan and Wisconsin, and the St. Lawrence Health System in northern New York. Attackers are targeting the sector with TrickBot malware, which often leads to ransomware, data theft, and disruption of healthcare services. TrickBot's operators have developed new functionality and tools to improve the speed and profitability of their attacks. Oh, joy. The ransomware in question is reportedly Ryuk, which typically is deployed as a payload from banking trojans like TrickBot. Ryuk first appeared in 2018 and has grown into a widespread threat targeting oil and gas facilities, financial and military data, and the education sector, as well as healthcare. This attack follows a September 28th ransomware attack against Universal Health Services and unrelated to this campaign, which took down the IT network that supports its facilities. Earlier that same month, ransomware targeting a German hospital led to the death of a patient who had to be transported to another facility as a result of that attack.
Be very, very quiet. We're hunting Oracle servers. Seems hackers are scanning the internet for machines that have yet to patch a recently disclosed flaw that forces Oracle's WebLogic server to execute malicious code, according to a researcher this last Wednesday. Johannes Ulrich, Dean of Research at the SANS Technology Institute, said his organization's honeypots had detected internet-wide scans that probe for vulnerable servers, CVE-2020-14882, as the vulnerability is tracked and it has a severity rating of 9.8 out of 10 on a CVSS scale. Oracle's October advisory accompanied a patch saying exploits are low in complexity and require low privileges and no user interaction. Oof. Quote, at this point, we are seeing the scan slow down a bit, Ulrich wrote in a post, but they have reached saturation, meaning that all IPv4 addresses have been scanned for this vulnerability. If you find a vulnerable server in your network, assume it has been compromised. So I do ask whether any database server really should be connected directly to the public internet in the first place instead of being behind a firewall. I suppose there are some good reasons for exposing a server, but I am more inclined to put it in and have the application servers behind the firewall and only expose the services via proxy of some sort. But you got to say,
Indeed you do. Now, China's top security agency announced plans recently for rectification of the Chinese mobile internet browser market. Now, the group argues the mobile internet browser space has, quote, become a gathering place of, quote, chaos. Now, Cyberspace Administration of China, or the CAC, said in a statement this week that mobile browsers in China have until November 9th to complete a self-examination. They must address, quotes, issues, including the spread of misinformation, sensational headlines, and content that conflicts with socialism values. This sounds familiar. Twitter. Now, according to the CAC, for some of the time, mobile browsers have grown in an uncivilized way. Also, having become a gathering place of amplifier for dissemination of chaos by self-media. Now, after rectification, mobile browsers that still have outstanding problems will be dealt with strictly according to laws and regulations until unrelated or related businesses are banned. The CEC focuses on the top 8 mobile browsers globally, including those run by Huawei Technology, Alibaba, UC Web, and Xiaomi. Now, China's policing of online information and technologies have raised broader concerns globally, especially with the U.S. Cyberspace Solarium Commission, CSC, publishing a white paper last week highlighting the, quote, China problem faced by the security of the information and communication technologies supply chain. Now, the imperative is clear here. In global trade, Chinese government interventions in its own domestic industry and standard-setting bodies have created an uneven playing field here. Now, companies in the United States and partner countries struggle to compete. The issue of isolation and scaling under their own standards will continue to be a problem unless the open market can save it.
Well, the SANS Institute has started a cybersecurity program for all high school students. Several years ago, the SANS Institute started Girls Go Cyber Start, a program aiming to introduce more high school girls to cybersecurity as a career field. Now, SANS has opened up the Cyber Start program to all U.S. high school students, not only girls, aiming to have some 56,000 students participate. SANS Cyber Start competition for 2020 officially opened this week for enrollment, and it's free. The competition begins on November 15th, and students can play through the end of February 2021. More than 30,000 young women from 2,500 U.S. schools participated in the Girls Go Cyber Start competition between 2018 and 2020, according to Alan Paller, Director of Research at SANS Institute and President of SANS Technology Institute. This year's Cyber Start competition includes $2 million in college scholarships for finalists to compete in for a challenge round in March or April, courtesy of sponsorship by the National Cyber Scholarship Foundation. SANS is now also working with schools' counselors in order to connect more students with CyberStart and ensure underprivileged students learn about it and have the opportunity to participate. Now, the reason the 2020 version of CyberStart expanded beyond girls only is bittersweet. Despite the participation of 30,000 young women over 3 years, there's been greater interest in the program from boys. So SANS thought it only made sense to open up the program to everyone rather than, quote, lose half the talent, end quote, according to Paller. Most experts attribute higher interest among male students to societal and systemic factors rather than any actual lack of interest among young women.
Well, the UK's communications regulator, Ofcom, is banning phone carriers from selling locked handsets starting in December of 2021 to make it easier for people to switch providers, according to the watchdog spokesperson. Although BBC News notes that many carriers like O2, Sky, Three, and Virgin already sell unlocked handsets as standard, others like EE, Vodafone, and Tesco Mobile sell phones that need to be manually unlocked before they can be used with other networks. Ofcom says the rules is part of a new set of measures designed to make it simpler to switch between cell carriers. According to its research, over a third of people who decide against switching say they are put off by having to unlock their phone first. Unlocking a phone costs around £10, $13 US in their country, according to the regulator. And the process can often cause problems like delays or loss of service. Well, I, for one, try to unlock all my devices just as soon as I've reached the carrier's rules, only because I'm not willing to pay full pop for my mobile phones, okay? And that's because a lot of mobile phones are subsidized. Seems fair. Anyway, but I ask, if the United States goes through this, but this is obviously the UK, will this also spell the end of cell phone subsidies? And that means you might be looking at $1,000 mobile handsets.
Now, 2020 has been a year that's full of lots of challenges. Cybersecurity is just one of them. In fact, cross-site scripted, or XSS, remained the most impactful vulnerability and thus the one reaping the highest rewards for ethical hackers in 2020 for a second year running, according to a list of top 10 vulnerabilities released recently. Now, you may already know cross-site scripting enables attackers to inject client-side scripts into web pages viewed by other users. Now, it has earned hackers $4.2 million in a total bug bounty awards in the last year, which is a 26% increase from what was paid out in 2019 for finding XSS flaws. Now, followed by that, the top 10 most impactful rewarded vulnerability types of 2020 list actually are improper access control, information disclosure, server-side request forgery or SSRF, insecure direct object reference, privilege escalation, of course, SQL injections in there, improper authentication, code injection, and of course, cross-site request forgery. Now, a bug bounty award for XSS flaw is about $501, well below the $3,650 average award for a critical flaw. Now, it allows organizations to mitigate the common bug on the cheap, if you think about it. Now, indeed, researchers found that the more familiar a vulnerability is, the less an ethical hacker is actually paid, and thus the less the organization pays out to locate and mitigate it. So that means finding the most common vulnerability type is actually inexpensive. Why aren't they doing it more, right? This demonstrates that using ethical hackers to sniff out bugs potentially can be more effective, a more cost-effective value proposition for organizations. Now, even more so than implementing, quote, the traditional security tools and methods which become more expensive and cumbersome as goals change and attack surfaces expand. Now, awards for improper access control increased 134% year over year to slightly more than $4 million, while bug bounties for information disclosure rose 63%. Now, it seems here that the accelerated pace of digital transformation has given security leaders a new perspective here on using ethical hacking to augment existing security resources, ultimately making them more willing to pay out to get results faster. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, you may have heard of advanced threat protection, especially as part of the current climate, something you want to have for your organization. Well, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they've actually observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, with many employees now working remotely, I definitely am, and each one of them are getting tons of email every day. I get thousands, and they are vulnerable. We're vulnerable, right? 91% of all cyber attacks start in an email. Now, spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking, multiply that by how many employees times how many emails you get. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, your customers, even your reputation. Get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. Now, it includes all-in-one email security, backup and archiving, AI-based protection for spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise, and an automated incident response system that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address those attacks. Now, security awareness training also helps to educate your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, one of Barracuda's premier customers is PetSmart, which used Barracuda and Microsoft's help to quickly secure their remote business during the pandemic. Now, if you'd like to hear how they did it, check out Barracuda's latest recorded webinar, called Securing Azure with PetSmart, Microsoft, and Barracuda. Now, you can get to that by visiting barracuda.com/PetSmart to view it now, and they'll get expert guidance in overcoming security challenges when migrating your IT infrastructure to a public cloud environment. That's barracuda.com/PetSmart. Now, ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. And don't forget to check out Barracuda's latest webinar, Securing Azure with PetSmart, Microsoft, and Barracuda. Go to barracuda.com/PetSmart. That's barracuda.com/PetSmart. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. But first, let me ask you a question. Let me throw a question out there. Do you trust your firewall? Well, a recent survey uncovers that organizations have some severe reservations about the effectiveness of their firewalls. Now, we're going to call those legacy firewalls for a second. Now, relatively high percentage of cybersecurity leaders apparently perceive most legacy firewall technologies as the long linchpin of enterprise security. Now, they believe that they're an ineffective way of protecting their applications against attacks. Now, a recent survey of 603 U.S. security professionals on their firewall use, the survey actually included both stateful firewalls that inspect incoming and outgoing traffic. It also included firewalls that integrated threat intelligence, intrusion protection, application access control, and other features. Now, the results, here we go, drum roll here. The results reveal that organizations are really unhappy, highly unhappy with their current firewall technologies. More than half, 53% of the respondents actually say that they're either moving away from or reducing their dependency on firewalls and looking for other options. Question is, what are those other options? Now, 6 out of 10 of the surveyed security leaders believe legacy firewalls don't have the capabilities to protect critical applications and systems from attack. Now, an identical 60% describes legacy firewalls as being really little help in enabling zero trust environments. So we've talked about zero trust in the past. It also says 76% say it took them too much time to secure new applications or change configurations with their legacy firewalls. And in fact, 57% say that sometimes it takes them as much as 3 weeks to a month to change firewall rules to accommodate and update their new applications. Now, 62% describe the access control policies available for their firewalls as not being granular enough. Now, what it seems like here is that organizations are hoping that these devices are the silver bullet of their security and finding out that they're not. Now, I want to bring my co-host in. Chibert, you've worked a lot with legacy firewalls in the past. Is this just old news?
It is and it isn't. Okay, so let's qualify that a little bit. I have done testing of a lot of legacy firewalls and so forth. But the reality is I have been using UTM, Unified Threat Management style firewalls now for the vast majority of my career. And to this date, none of my facilities have been hacked. And that's because I have, even before perimeter security was dead and before it was fashionable, I always set my systems up in a zone defense type of thing. And my UTMs will always try and go and look at all the traffic as it goes in between each zone. This is what I see lacking. I go into a lot of organizations and the firewall only has a LAN and a WAN. It's like, where's the rest of your zones? Oh, that's all we need. It's like, no, that's not all you need. I can't. Even really big corporations have this problem. And I see a lot of these corporations, the firewall people make you jump through an amazing amount of hoops, lots of forms, lots of sign-offs and so forth to get a firewall rule changed. And then I start looking at what's involved. And it's like, you guys are, I admit, the command line is great. You can do a lot of stuff with the command line and all that things. But that means you have to have a high-end person driving that firewall. It's no secret, I've been really high on SonicWall, and that's because I have the option of being at the command line for those people that have the training and want to go fast and want to do scripting and things like that and use a lot of special expressions in your programming, all fine and good. But what about the kids that are just starting? What about the person that's filling in while the experts on maternity leave or paternity leave. That's when a GUI comes in. And this is my big, big, big complaint about a lot of these so-called giant enterprise grade firewalls. It's like you're relying so heavily on someone that has spent their entire career doing firewalls that changes become difficult. So in answer to all this, I don't think firewalls are the problem. I think it's how you drive the firewalls that are the problem.
Good point. I do want to come back to that because I have a question about maybe automation might help here. But before I get to that, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. Now, we've discussed perimeter security and how it's old news. Like we've talked a lot about zero trust along with micro segmentation and how it might be the wave of the future. Does that make legacy firewalls obsolete here then?
You know, I want to compare this to something that happened when I was very young. That was the introduction of airbags in cars. You know, I remember when airbags started to be put into cars, when they were arguing in favor of them. The argument was that seatbelts would no longer be required. You know, you would just get into your car. If something happened, airbags would pop out. You would be just wrapped in the Stay Puffed marshmallow of safety and life would be perfect. Well, as it turns out, that's not the case. Airbags are really good, but you still need the seat belts and the shoulder belts to keep you in place for them to protect you. I think the legacy firewall is like that. Microsegmentation is going to make a huge difference. It's going to be much safer. It's based on a much better premise for security in that it's risk-based rather than protection-based. With that said, you still want the firewall in place. Why? Because it screens out so much of the noise. Because it will catch some of the attacks coming in. And it makes it so much easier for all of the zero-trust infrastructure to be more effective. So the time is past when you can depend upon the legacy firewall for all your protection, but I don't think we're going to be able to do without it for a long time into the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the interesting thing about this is that a lot of these organizations are saying, you know what, we thought this was a silver bullet. Now that we've implemented this, it's not. So let's go find something else. Is that really the answer here is the question. So, Cheebert, I want to throw this back to you. Talked a little bit about tooling and maybe automating some things. Would that help here? Would that make this easier? A lot of them are complaining about the fact that it takes too long to upgrade the rules and the policies of these things. Or like you said, you know, a third party might come in and that might take over for somebody who's like on vacation or something and throw a bad policy. In fact, we've seen big cloud services like Amazon push policy issues and rule issues out to the cloud and actually take their entire service down. So is this where automation's going to come and save the day? And then, like Curtis said, still allow organizations to use those firewalls along with some of the newer technologies?
Oh, you bet. AI is going to be a saving grace. Now, in a traditional firewall, an AI is not going to help a whole lot because traditional firewalls are not very agile at changing. Now, when you start talking about a firewall that would be more considered a unified threat appliance or something like that, where the IDS IPS is built in, that's where AI is really going to make a difference. And if a firewall vendor isn't talking AI yet, they're behind the curve. I can really see, you know, especially on things like firewall UTM appliances are saying we can deal with zero-day characterization is getting harder and harder. This is no longer the day of like Slammer where you can just close a TCP or UDP port. You can't do that anymore. You're now having to go and look at the packet and see what's in the packet, how the packets are arranged, and you need something that can keep track of a large number of packets to deal with the low and slow attacks. So AI is going to be the next big thing. And AI is going to be what is necessary to deal with just a huge number of hackers and attacks and malicious this and that that are imploding themselves against the enterprise. And trust me, if you put a firewall driver in the seat where they are indispensable, you've lost already. You need people that can do many, many things, and that AI and things like that are going to make it easier for you to have the coverage, because when the firewall rules and changing things start getting in the way of you making money, game over.
That's right. That's right. I mean, single point of failure is always a bad thing. So I agree with you, Super. Curtis, I want to throw the last question to you here. Now, we hear a lot of organizations moving to a hybrid cloud or moving or digital transforming to the cloud, and they're starting to use, you know, SD-WANs, software-defined WANs, and they're also starting to move to the concept of next-generation firewalls, things like Cisco offers these things, which do implement more threat protection, threat intelligence, AI, that kind of thing. Is that something that's going to change the landscape here? Or is these things just traditional firewalls, just at a much higher scale?
No, they're really not just traditional firewalls at scale. Next-gen firewalls really are doing some things different. Among other things, they are getting involved with a lot of deep packet inspection. They're looking within the packet as well as simply looking at the wrapper for the packet. In addition, next-gen firewalls are really what you have to have if you're going to do a hybrid architecture where you have both on-premises and cloud services as part of your architecture. So I think that we're going to see more and more organizations going to next-gen firewalls because they must. If you want to have any hope of wrapping a security blanket around your entire infrastructure, the traditional firewall just isn't going to do it. It's great for on-premises stuff. It's great if you're trying to protect, say, a branch office, something like that. But if you're doing the sort of big, sprawling, partially cloud-based architecture that most enterprises are these days, next-gen is the way to go.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, it's definitely a complex area. We should definitely maybe get a guest on to walk us through some of the complexities here. We'll have to try to get that in the future. But let's go ahead and jump into next bite here. Now, a lot of you have a ton of IoT devices on your network. I definitely do, and a lot of organizations do as well. But we're starting to discuss this point that we can't figure out what the rogue ones are, like what the ones causing the problems. Cheever, is there some good ways to do that?
Okay, first and foremost, I both agree and disagree with this article in the same way. The article goes on to say, basically says, a lot of these new IoT devices are based on, they say Raspberry Pis. I'm going to change that to single board computers. There is a huge number. There are thousands of single board computers out there. And one of the common threads is they almost all run Linux. In fact, a lot of IoT devices are based on Linux. It's got, apparently, a lot of people starting up and building these little IoT devices have given up on the mature single board computer or embedded systems, operating systems like the ones from Wind River. So the problem is this. The part that I do agree on is a lot of these IoT devices, their traffic's unencrypted. And I go back and say, hey, excuse me, you're running Linux. Linux has actually deprecated unencrypted everything a long time ago. Why aren't you taking advantage of this? So for that, I agree. There's a lot of things. So the article goes on to say, about a year ago, Pearson and the Wake security team hypothesized that we'd be able to analyze the behavior of a device and in doing so distinguish IoT and operational technology devices from mobile devices, BYOD systems, corporate infrastructure, and enterprise devices. They not only learned this was possible, but discovered myriad ways these connected devices put businesses at risk. And again, I go back to, what are you people doing in the IoT world? Why are you doing unencrypted anything in this day and age? So it goes on. I've got to cut it a little bit short because we got to make sure we have enough time for our guests. But they start going and ask, how do you know if an IoT device is malicious? My answer on this is you can't really, because an IoT device could have a mission critical application like the one I'm designing for a medical laboratory, where we want to have a secondary remote temperature monitoring system so we can tell when the -80 freezers are having problems, or if we're low on liquid nitrogen in a particular door and things like that. That's mission critical, but it's based on a Raspberry Pi. But you can design secure IoT applications, and I say to the industry, why aren't you? So what I want to throw to Kurt is, have you started hearing about other mission critical IoT type things, and are they playing well in the enterprise, or do we still have a long ways to go?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on exactly what you're talking about, as is so often the case in these things. When you're talking about IoT, or as it's beginning to be referred to in the enterprise, OT for operational technology, a lot of the devices that come from traditional SCADA and manufacturing systems are very robust. What they aren't is flexible and easy to program. So what you're seeing is a lot of these devices based on some of the newer single board computers that are going into very innovative, very experimental devices that are being used, especially in smaller and more cutting edge manufacturing floors. Now, those have some really entertaining problems. The thing that's really interesting, and I actually wrote an article on this today that's going to be published sometime in the next week or so. Many of the OT devices that we're seeing are not based on Linux so much as they are on embedded Windows. And we're seeing a lot of single board Intel-based computers that are functionally very similar to what you might have in a laptop or a desktop being used for process control. And that is beginning to make some of the assembly line and process control devices subject to the same kind of ransomware and rat and other kind of malware that we're now wrestling with in IT. And that really is where a lot of things are going to get interesting, where not only the data stream, but the security problems converge across the IT and the OT sides of the house.
The bottom line is the world needs to change. The IoT world and now the OT world is still growing up. We had a guest on a couple weeks ago from Intel, and they were talking about all kinds of neat things, and I accidentally kind of pushed them into a corner asking about new platforms, and they had to shy away from that question. And I'm just going to speculate, this is purely me speculating, that Intel is going to join the ranks of a lot of people like NVIDIA and so forth that are putting out dramatically more advanced single board computers to be able to meet the demand. Now, when I've talked to some IoT developers, they've said, well, we aren't doing that because there's not enough horsepower on a Raspberry Pi. I go, what freaking Raspberry Pi are you doing? Are you trying to do it on a Raspberry Pi Zero, for goodness sakes? Come on. The new Pis have a lot of horsepower. I'm sorry. No excuses. Especially with the new platforms coming out from Intel, NVIDIA, and so forth, there is a huge surplus of horsepower available to you. There is no excuses not to encrypt. There is no excuses not to apply the same kinds of rules that you would to an enterprise server or an enterprise workstation. So I think I'm done with my soapbox. We need to do better. IoT and OT needs to grow up. We understand it's in the infancy, but you can learn from your elders. And I think that is what we really need to go and hammer on.
Indeed, indeed, indeed.
So
thank you, Cheever. Well, next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twi Riot. But before we get to that, we have to thank another great guest, another great sponsor, that is, of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ZipRecruiter. Now, businesses need to be flexible this year, from working remotely to pivoting their business models for long-term survival and growth. Now, restaurants are moving their dining outdoors and adding takeout and catering. Now, some customers' packaged goods companies actually have shifted to focus more on surface cleaners. Now, major retailers are now selling face masks. If you're in charge of hiring for your business, these pivots have made your job even more challenging. Thankfully, there's one place they can always count on to make hiring faster and easier, and that's ZipRecruiter.com/Twiat. Now, ZipRecruiter's technology finds people with the right experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. Now, it's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. That's right. I've actually used ZipRecruiter in the past, and I'll tell you one thing. I posted out there, and I posted a set of skills I was looking for, a very specific set of skills, and they were able to connect me very, very quickly. Within just a couple days, I was able to connect with some really great candidates, and you know, through the whole interviewing process, the interviewing process took longer than just even finding really good candidates, and we were able to actually fulfill the position pretty quickly. So it was really great working with ZipRecruiter. See for yourself. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twiat. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TWIET. Let ZipRecruiter take hiring off your plate. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Twiat. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on us. And today we have Mike Paler. He's VP of Product and Engineering at Upwork. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to Upwork?
Sure. Started my career at General Electric working on remote monitoring and diagnostic systems for locomotives, which was an interesting way to start my engineering career. I moved on to PayPal, and for the better part of a decade, I was there managing low latency risk and fraud management systems. Most recently, I've been with Upwork for the last 3.5 years as VP of engineering and product, managing a global workforce of around 300 engineers in 20 plus countries.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, we know Upwork helps organizations find talent to meet their needs. And obviously this market has, and this industry has quite changed over the last 6 to 9 months. Can you maybe take us through just how the market is shifting and what you're seeing even from a talent acquisition model, where they're going, like where they're actually putting their money in and where they're trying to find talent for?
Sure. So Upwork is the world's largest work marketplace, and we help connect millions of businesses with talent all over the globe. In particular, web and mobile software development is our single largest category or set of categories. And so clients of all sizes, from Fortune 500 firms to small businesses alike, are looking for technology help, for mobile apps, for data science, any number of technical skills. And they come to Upwork looking for that because it's really hard to find that skilled talent all over the world, in particular in the U.S., depending on your location. So they come to Upwork looking for web and mobile software development help. Like I said, mobile, data science, even marketing, design, and creative. Those are pretty big categories for us as well. So we're seeing a shift, especially since coronavirus. Basically, everyone's adopted to a remote model, at least partially. And right. People are coming to us looking for talent because they were having trouble finding it before. And we have a base of millions of freelancers that have the talent and the proven reputation on the system to actually back it up.
Now, the interesting thing here is a lot of times you go to these freelance markets. There's a lot of them. I think Upwork is obviously mm-hmm. one on the top there. And I think one of the things that's interesting is you do find a lot of web, mobile designers, that kind of thing. But the one thing that we're seeing, obviously, in the current landscape is a lot more needs for, like you were saying, more data science, more security experts. That kind of thing. Are you seeing any asks there? Any organizations, trying to find more people in that type of sector?
Yeah, absolutely. Notoriously, information security is just really difficult to find experts. And I think that if you look across the wide array of technologies, frameworks, and implementations of security protocols, like Upwork is a great place to find talent of many different types. Data science in particular, even at Upwork, we leverage our own platform to staff up data science. So machine learning experts, supervised and unsupervised learning models, even just general analytics. So we're seeing a strong demand for all those types of technology skills where people are, there's a high demand. There's also a high degree of technical capability needed, and clients are coming to Upwork looking for that kind of talent.
Right. Yeah. Now you mentioned high degree of technical ability. Like we talked a lot about in our past articles here about security, even the effectiveness of firewalls and that kind of thing. Where are you seeing, especially in the topic of security, where are you seeing more asks? Where are you seeing the organizations looking for talent when it comes to security? Is it infrastructure security? Is it software security? That kind of thing. Where is it happening? And where are you seeing it evolving?
Yeah, I think in general, we're seeing it across the board. In particular, identity and access management, privilege access management, and security, in my opinion, is all about automation. And so I think in general, even general purpose programming skills can help to sort of evolve a security posture of a company. If we can automate, then we can secure. And I think if you think about security in layers, you can find experts in particular technologies, which is great. A particular firewall, a particular security defense system, but you can also hire general purpose talent to help automate and secure pipelines, secure workloads, like secure access for everyone at the company. And I think that's where we're seeing people, moving toward infrastructure as code and automation just to standardize and develop a better security posture. So Upwork is a great place to find talent for that. In particular for individual systems where there's a particular niche skill needed. We have millions of experts. And so you can really find exactly what you're looking for, which is a nice thing.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think that's the interesting thing here is I think we're, one, obviously a lot of people more remote, and you even mentioned this, that, that organizations are looking for more talent. Let me ask you a question. Are they hand in hand? Could it be that organizations who are going remote, people want to potentially not necessarily stay in the place that they've been at traditionally, let's say here in Seattle where I live, too expensive. I'm working remote, might as well go somewhere else. And maybe some organizations are not too happy with that. Are they going to Upwork to say, hey, I need to become a freelancer. I need to be able to work remotely. I need to be able to, are you seeing a more uptick that sense, or is it just organizations looking for more people to target particular parts of their business?
It's both. In particular on the talent side, we've seen a huge influx of new talent since March of this year in particular. It's always been a strong demand. We get hundreds of thousands of people applying to join Upwork any given day. But there's been a huge surge in demands in particular since coronavirus. And I think the notion of working from home or at least remote work and being part of a distributed team or being an independent business where you can take your skill, offer your services on a place like Upwork, know you're going to get secure payment, secure reputation, feedback, transparent feedback from clients. Those are things where you can help build a business. So talent has been coming to us all year long, looking to showcase their skills and earn a book of business with clients that way. So we're really seeing it on both sides, which is a great network effect for us. And in particular, we've seen talent coming in across the board, across the globe. And I think coronavirus was a great impetus for that.
Now, interesting stats. I saw a recent report that came out that says that 75% of freelancers make more than their normal steady job. And in fact, some of them say that 71% of them say that freelancing as a full-time career is even more acceptable to them. Is this flooding the market with freelancers, or is this saying that, hey, this is a place where I can go and broaden my skills and use them in a way where I can actually make more money than my normal day job?
Yeah, I think it's both. We see you know, independent professionals wanting to form their own business and, you know, do that full time. We also see people doing it sort of to keep up their skills, to earn more income. There's a myriad of reasons why the talent comes to us. So we see it on both sides. I think that generally speaking, the statistics are skewing in favor of worldwide freelancing, in particular in the U.S. We have a couple of reports out there that talk about the statistics, but the freelancing world is growing. And I think the freedom and flexibility to bring your skills to an organization is enticing for a lot of people. I also think that there are practical reasons to keep up your skills, to learn new skills that you might not get in your current organization. So we're seeing a mix of both of those, but certainly more and more people are freelancing.
Makes sense. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they have a lot of questions here. Kurt, let's start with you.
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in, and this is something back in a different lifetime when I was doing some hiring, I wrestled with, and that is when you've got someone looking for work, you've got their credentials, which often means certifications, and then you have their experience, yes, which I know in some cases today can include things like a portfolio that they've got on GitHub. Do you have a good sense of which of those employers are more interested in seeing, or do employers want to see both of those?
They'd like to see both. In particular, we have skilled certifications where you can label those on your profile. You have, every freelancer or every talent has a profile. But I think in particular, the verified work history over the course of months or years is in particular important to clients looking for how is this person going to do the job? Are they going to fit in? Do they have a history of delivering on time? And our platform provides a transparent reputation system so that you can validate the skills in some way in an interview, just like you do with any other talent. You could also look at their certifications, AWS Solutions Architect Certified, things of that nature. But I think the verifiable work reputation, which is transparent, is just really powerful. And the clients in particular rely on that. We have an algorithm called a job success score, which helps them understand how applicable that person is to their needs. And some of them are really looking for 100% delivery. And that's something that you can see in a transparent way on our platform. So I think the answer is both. And even internally, as we hire, we're looking for skilled individuals that have a verifiable reputation. But we also look at their soft skills, their technical skills, and we hire for that as well. So I think, Kurt, the answer is both.
Okay. Now you brought up something really interesting, and that's the soft skills. You talk about teamwork, fitting in, all of that.
Yes.
You know, the reputation of the technologist, the technical expert, is that, you know, we tend not to have any human skills. You know, finding a human readable developer is something of a unicorn. Are you saying that companies actually don't just want the technology wizards, that they want, you know, people who have a user friendly interface?
Absolutely. I think that at times you're going to want a particular skill for a particular project, and we have a model that supports fixed price projects very well for that. We also have a model that supports hourly, in particular, like staff augmentation, where you expect that talent to join your team, particularly for weeks, months, or even years. And I think our platform provides the capability. So in that scenario, you're really looking at how well do they fit into the team? How well do they understand the business model? Can they help me innovate? And that's a key differentiator when you bring an independent talent on. They may not necessarily be looking to just take orders. And I think that soft skills, teamwork, communication, collaboration, we're all remote right now. And that is pretty critical when you're going to work with a product manager, design, marketing on launching something new to customers. It's a pretty important skill to have. So we see our customers looking at both the technical hard skills as well as the soft skills.
Thanks, Kurt. T-Bert?
You know, I've been a big fan of generalists versus specialists. And so my question is the job market reflecting that? are corporations only looking for specialists, or are corporations finally starting to see the value of generalists that can see the bigger picture?
I think that what I'm seeing is a trend toward generalist. Like I said, in particular, there are projects where you're going to need someone familiar with a select framework or a piece of technology that you're looking to learn to build out a skill for in your team. But in general, I think we're seeing people hiring programmers and looking to use them in a multitude of ways. And that's exactly how we hire as well. So I would say they're more generalists. That doesn't mean people aren't also looking for particular technology skill or particular certifications. That happens as well. Certainly in our organization, we bring people in with a broad computer science background or a general background that would help make them more applicable to many roles at the company. And I think a lot of organizations are doing the same thing.
So I do want to shift the conversation just a bit. Obviously, a lot of people are going to the freelance market to not only become more remote, more versatile, get away from the big companies, but also being, make a lot more money here. And I think one thing I have a question to you is, you know, obviously Upwork follows this model of being kind of a marketplace for freelancers where they can go and post their skills. You help find, you know, you help kind of connect the dots for people, for organizations. And, you know, obviously Upwork has a little upside to that because they get a little bit of a cut. Are you seeing that freelancers are looking for something else? They're looking to make more and get away from, potentially saying, hey, you know, now that I have the skills, I want to use my skills in a way where I don't have to be part of a marketplace to do it. Are you seeing anything like that? Or are you seeing that people are still, you know, looking to put themselves out there in a place where they can get found and be found and be connected to the right organizations?
I think it's both. There are a lot of great benefits to marketplaces like ours, and there we have many competitors, as you've noted. In particular, payment protection, online reputation, and transparency. I think that the platforms provide those to clients, and there's a really great reason to put your work on Upwork. There may be reasons to also not do that, but I think we're seeing an influx of people because you can build a great reputation on Upwork, and you can be assured for payment, which I think we have a mutually beneficial system in that way, where clients can be assured that they don't pay until they sign off on the deliverable or sign off on the hours, and freelancers are protected against clients who can't pay by proof of the work that they've done. And that is one of the great advantages of using a marketplace. So they can set their own rates, they can negotiate every contract, and they still have the flexibility to run their business the way they see fit. They get the added benefit of our protections and our introduction to them, introduction of clients to them, which is a huge, you know, lead gen is like, you know, everything. We need to actually help bring them work. And so I think marketplaces in particular have a distinct benefit over non. Now, there is a fee. That is true. So I think the value of that, has to be judged. But that's, those are some of the benefits that we provide.
Makes sense. So I've worked with a lot of companies, a lot of vendor companies, and a lot of times we'll need more than one person. Obviously, we'll need a team of people that have either similar skills or maybe even different skills. Is this something that Upwork can help with? And along with that question is, you know, once we find these skills, some of them might not, like we were talking about before, might not have the software skills, like the project management or program management skills to be able to manage their themselves, or even, you know, the work that they're working on, the requirements, that kind of thing. Is that something that Upwork helps with as well?
Yes, we have an agency's capability as well. I think rather than just independence, there are agencies on the platform that a lot of our clients are looking in case they want to scale out or they want different skills or a variety of skills. We have a number of agencies on the platform that help meet their needs. So we do have individuals as well. But agencies is a great example of I probably need more of a team. Or I need that interface point. And you realize there's overhead to that, but you need that interface point, and that's a great model for agencies. So agencies offer their services on Upwork as well, and it's a great way for them to, you know, find clients and ensure they get paid as well.
So that's interesting you brought up. So agencies, so is that just adding another layer into the model here? Because I guess my worry would be that, and maybe you can debunk this worry, is that if there's an additional middleman, there's probably additional cut, which means potentially the people that I'm getting are getting less money. And so you won't necessarily get the best talent because of that. Is that something that's real, or am I just, trying to make sense of it all?
I think in short, we have profiles for everyone on the platform. They get to set their own rates. I think, agencies in particular have unique benefits where they might be actually upcharging, but they set their own rate and it's transparent to the clients right from the start. So that is something that when you work with talent on the platform, if they're a part of an agency, you understand if they're an individual. And that is something that our platform helps provide transparency for as well. As to the sort of worry that you have, I think that one of the things we allow is these clients and freelancers to work together upfront pretty collaboratively. Right. So therefore, you can ask those kind of questions like, okay, who's going to actually be working on this? Can I meet them? And really, the idea is that you interface with that person all the time. And that rich collaboration helps you understand who the person is, what they're capable of, and what their role is in the agency. So we support a lot of transparency and collaboration to help, ensure that clients understand who they're working with, as well as, what that agency can do for them.
Right. Mike Pillar, all good things must come to end. Thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I do want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can go, where they can learn more about Upwork and how they can get started and maybe using and getting some talent out there.
Sure. Yeah. So you can go to www.upwork.com and you can register as a freelancer if you're talented and want to put your professional skills on our marketplace. You can peruse clients and see who's hiring. If you're a business that want to look for talent, you can actually go to the same site, register, and immediately get started posting a job or looking at talent that we have available. We have thousands of skills, millions of freelancers to look through and choose from. So definitely encourage you guys to go there and see if you can provide your services or even find the talent that you've been looking for. And Upwork provides both of those. So thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat to another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you online?
Well, Twitter is a good place. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or just do like a whole bunch of other people are doing. Drop me an email. I'm chibert@twit.tv. Better yet, why don't you hit twyatt@twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. We'd love to hear your ideas. And I want to do a shout out to Loquacious in the chat room. Thank you very much for the chat about specialists versus generalists and ageism in the workforce. Good input. Thank you so very much. And before too long, I'm hoping before the new year to be coming to you from the great state of Florida. We're getting really, really close to pulling the trigger on scheduling the movers and moving very far away.
Well, good luck to you there, Cheever. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find all of your work?
Well, got a lot of writing going on, a lot of stories to tell, and getting ready for a dark reading virtual event coming up on November 12th. If you head over to darkreading.com, you can find the registration page for an event that's all about finding and dealing with intrusions to your system. Great thing is, it's free. So come over and take a look. Check it out. In the meantime, if you want to follow me and see what all I'm doing, you can keep up with me on Twitter. I'm KG4GWA, or on Instagram, Kurt_Franklin. Look forward to seeing you both those places, as well as right back here on Twyatt.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you guys for all your support. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT news. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to get your enterprise news and IT news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, all the show notes, the co-hosts, the guest information, all the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, any one of your podcast applications, Podcatchers, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, you name it. We're there. Subscribe, support the show. It's the best way to stay on an enterprise, stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So might as well go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because we talk about a lot of fun subjects on here, a lot of great tech topics. I can guarantee they will find them interesting as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the during Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, we do the show live, live.twit.tv. Come on and join the live stream. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see the behind the scenes. We all have really great fun here on Twit, and you can come and watch it live. But if you're going to watch it live, you might as well be part of our chat room live as well. We have a great chat room, irc.twit.tv. We have a great set of characters out there. As you saw, Cheever, we got some great questions during the show and some great comments and discussion points. So definitely join the chat room live as well. And of course, that if you're not, you can't watch the show live and you can't actually be part of the discussion live, that's okay. There's still a community out there for you. There's still a 24/7 discussion community at twit.community. All the hosts are out there. We talk about all the different shows and the topics on the shows, different technology topics that are coming out. Definitely check that out at twit.community. Of course, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, I have great conversations with people like you. And of course, I post some of my work that I do at Microsoft out there as well. And if you want to check some of that out, you can go to developer.microsoft.com/office. It can help you actually customize your office experience to make it more productive for you and your organization. I also want to make sure I thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. Of course, I want to thank all the staff and engineers at Twit. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Cheegiebert one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we couldn't do the show without him. So thanks again, Cheegiebert, for all your support and all your help. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor behind the scenes. He makes us look good. Victor, thank you so much. And of course, our TD today, Jammer B. Jammer B, what's going on over there at the Twit Studios? You guys keeping busy?
Oh, you know, we're doing our regular stuff. I hear there's a pizza being made. I got to find out where that pizza's being made. So it's about time for that pizza to be ready.
Me too. Thanks, Jammer B, for all your support. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twit.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, host at Twit TV. Got a question for you. Have you gotten tired of how bad your photos are looking every time you post them to Instagram? Better yet, have you gotten yourself a new camera and you can't quite figure out why the images just don't look that good? Well, I have a solution for you. It's my show, Hands On Photography. Each and every Thursday, I sit down to share different tips and tricks that are going to help make you a better photographer and a better post processor. So subscribe today at twit.tv/hop to learn more.